This podcast is brought to you by eHarmony, the dating app to find someone you can be yourself with. Why doesn't eHarmony allow copy and paste in first messages? Because you are unique, and your conversations should reflect that. eHarmony wants you to find someone who will get you. How are you going to know who gets you? If people send you the same generic conversation starters, they message everyone else. Conversations that actually help you get to know each other. Imagine that. Get who gets you on eHarmony. Sign up today.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Welcome again to the Explaining History podcast, and I am very honoured to be joined today by Lauren Lesage Shepherd, an academic from the University of New Orleans. We're talking today about her book Resistance from the Right, a history of the kind of conservative resistance in academia and on campuses to the progressive changes and radicalism of the 1960s. It's a fascinating part of the kind of the story we think we all know about America in the 60s, but very often there's less of a focus on the actual conservative backlash that emerged from that decade, which arguably is kind of one of the more important things to look at. But anyway, welcome Lauren. It's lovely to have you here.
Thank you, Nick. It's great to be here.
Okay. So to begin with, perhaps you could tell us a little bit about the ideas behind the book and the writing of the book and where it kind of came from.
Sure. So the origin story is that before this was a book, it was my dissertation. And before it was my dissertation, it was just a paper. And it started with a question that I had. So this would have been 2015 or 2016, it was during Donald Trump's first run for president in the U.S. And I was taking a history of higher ed course, and I was, you know, reading all about campus radicalism. And I was thinking, Trump would have been a college student in 1968 and 1969. So what was he doing? Where did he fall in the story? And so in trying to find where Trump, the student, was, turns out he wasn't active at all. He obviously was evading the draft. He did that several times, which was not uncommon for men of his social connection and his wealth. But I found some other people whose names I was very familiar with in U.S. political history, people like Karl Rove and Jeff Sessions and so many others that appear in the book. And the story just kind of kept going from there. And what I found out in writing this paper is that there was a very boisterous sort of conservative and even far right pushback from college students themselves. And so, yeah, paper became dissertation, became book. And now I think it's a career long research interest of mine.
Fantastic. Sometimes that happens, doesn't it? You know, something that starts off as a general wondering, you find out and go, oh, this is now my life. Okay.
But exactly.
I that happened to me years ago when I wondered why so many Western intellectuals went to the Soviet Union in the 1930s, and then one thing led to another, and here we are. So we We talk about some of these individuals, these names. For those that are perhaps the name Karl Rove is sort of on the edge of your thoughts. This is the person who was described as Bush's brain, Bush's kind of George W. Bush's political strategist, who I think was kind of sidelined when Trump came along. That sort of generation of kind of neocons. Didn't fare very well.
He is still around though. I mean, you see him pop up on Fox News every so often with comments. And like all others of the Republican Party, they've sort of fallen in line around Trump. So any opposition that was there earlier,
Right.
I don't think he's a never Trumper today.
No. No. Well, so often you just get individuals are gifted in sensing where the power is and thinking, well, might as well. So when we talk about this development of kind of a conservative backlash in campuses across America, is it particularly a grassroots thing? Are these people self-organizing, or are there vested interests with money behind?
So it's a little bit of both. It's mostly that they're the phrase I use in the book is astroturf, meaning it looks like it's grassroots. It looks natural and organic, but actually there are some pretty powerful forces with deep pockets, lots of money behind them, sort of training and coaching and showing them how to organize. And so, yeah, I mean, I will say the far right students. I'm not sure if your listeners are familiar with David Duke, but he's an American political figure. Most importantly, he's known globally as a white supremacist. So David Duke was one of these college students, and he, I think, was actually organic. I can't find that he had, big money powers behind him. I think all of the organizing he did came, unfortunately, from the heart. But some of the other students in the bigger groups that I looked at, like Young Americans for Freedom, they go by YAF. Also, the College Republicans, they had mentors who were two or three generations older than them. Providing them money and showing them, here's how to organize a counter protest, or here's how to write an op-ed for your local newspaper. Here's how to attract media coverage for the events that you might be throwing. So yeah, they had a lot of supervision and a lot of guidance.
And back then, I mean, it's more very much more porous now, but you have David Duke, who was a kind of significant member of the Ku Klux Klan. And you have these various kind of conservative, groups, groups of conservative students. Now it's arguable that there is no kind of firewall between conservatism and what you would just simply call fascism. There's a kind of a huge overlap between the two, and Trumpist kind of populism has broken that down. Would you say that there was that firewall existed then in the kind of late 60s, early 70s, where conservative students thinking, no, we don't associate with that sort of thing?
Yes, I'm glad that you asked that. This is actually, it's been kind of hotly contested in political history. There is a camp of American historians who say what we're experiencing is not fascism, right? Fascism, it was a German and Italian thing in the 1930s and 40s, and it looked a certain way. And then there's another camp who says, no, this is American fascism in 2020, and that's why it doesn't look like that. And so that's a big debate. I tend to fall on the latter half. So throughout the post-war era, your listeners may be familiar with William F. Buckley Jr., who is sort of considered to be the leader of the post-war conservative movement in the US. And Buckley's very famous magazine, the National Review, sort of functioned as an organ to kind of weed out, who are the respectable conservatives that we can publish. At least that's how the story has been told. But one of the things that I argue in the book is that if you just scratch that just a little, if you just challenge that hypothesis or that claim, you'll find that it's not true. Buckley frequently published people who we would call on the far right, people who are self-described fascist or neo-Nazis. The thing is, he just blotted out that language when their editorials were in his magazine. But if you knew, if you're familiar with names like Revelo Oliver is a is a good example. You could find Revel Oliver's writing in the American Opinion and in Holocaust denying magazines.
Right.
So these, you know, these people were there, right? Buckley's obviously not going to let them say, you know, all the things that they want to say, but he'll publish the stuff that he likes. And so, yeah, I tend to fall in the camp that these divisions, these lines were never fiercely or solidly drawn.
Yeah. I mean, one of my thoughts about kind of Trumpism is that a lot of it is about now saying the quiet part out loud, whereas in previous kind of the fringes between conservatism and kind of like fascist thought, that the quiet bit was said very quietly indeed, in previous eras. And there's stuff that you couldn't articulate. Coming along to Buckley, he because he's like you say, he's this sort of pivotal figure in this movement. Where is he in terms of the story of kind of this conservative backlash on campus? Where does he figure?
Yeah, he's at the beginning. So I open the book with a vignette about George Wallace speaking, who is a former Republican governor of Alabama, who was a known segregationist, and he was speaking at Dartmouth in 1967. And so I open the book with this question, like, what was this guy doing, you know, at an Ivy League campus at the height of the campus wars? And then from there, I can backtrack to show. This actually has a much longer history, and you can get into the 30s, but a good starting point for the story is in the 1950s when Buckley had graduated from Yale. The very first book that he published was sort of this like diatribe or this lamentation of what we would call wokeism today on Yale's campus. Of course, that word didn't exist back then, but that's basically what his complaint was, that the university was too liberal, it was too open-minded, it had lost its Christian roots, and it was moving in a socialist direction. And so from there, Buckley became the founding member of a campus organization, the Intercollegiate Studies Institute. And then also YAF about not quite 10 years later, but in 1960, he founds YAF. And so those two organs have different purposes. ISI is like the intellectual group. It's still around today. They recruit conservatives, young conservatives, and they pay for their credentials to give them PhDs or JDs or some other advanced degree so that they'll stay in the academy or in important policy-making decisions in the US that affect the academy. So that's ISI. The other organization that he founds in 1960, Young Americans for Freedom, also still around today as Young Americans Foundation, that's an activist camp. So they train students to be activists, right? To host demonstrations and to today there's a lot of social media work, but to essentially call attention to themselves and their cause.
And you mentioned sort of Buckley talking about campus being, moving away from these kind of conservative Christian values. And obviously, kind of one of the things that you've seen in the last perhaps 40 years in America, maybe even longer, has been a kind of like a huge Christian revival. Did the two overlap? Was kind of are these kind of campus conservatives, is Christianity one of their key motivations, or is that a sort of a peripheral issue?
No, it's definitely always there. I mean, these were you know, by all means church going white squares is the way that they describe themselves. In terms of like the politics of it all, you really don't see like Christian coalitions get folded into the GOP and to the Republican Party until about the 1970s. So that, I mean, that's on the heels of my book. So yeah, I mean, there's some links there for sure. One of the campus groups that I talk a little bit about in the book is called, they're called CRU today, but it's Campus Crusade for Christ. And the thing that they were so great at doing on campus, it was fundraising because they were extremely attractive, right? They would go around door to door knocking, asking for money, and just presenting themselves as, you know, the square white anti-hippies that they were. And yeah, college Republicans borrowed that technique as well. So yeah, I mean, it's all there. It's all in the mix for sure.
And I think there's always one thing to remember about the 1960s and the kind of mythologization of the 1960s. And this is probably true of any time period. Most people aren't engaged in the counterculture in the 1960s, and they certainly weren't here in Great Britain. I asked my parents about the 1960s. They said they went on caravan holidays, and that was as radical as they got. And most people aren't taking LSD. Most people aren't going on protests. Most people aren't going to Woodstock. They live painfully ordinary lives because that's the politics of the everyday, isn't it? And so there is a, you know, I think that this sort of perception, again, it's a popular culture perception of campus radicalism. That's a really tiny, tiny, tiny number of people. And maybe that was part of the reason why the backlash against it, A, is so successful, because I think it really was successful, but also there were, you know, people worrying about, you know, the American way of life, whatever you want to call that. But it was, I doubt it was ever really under any kind of threat from college students.
No, absolutely not. And it's funny too, because so many people think of the campus radicals as being, you know, anti-war and just devoted to this cause of anti-imperialism and anti-capitalism. And that's very true from some of the loudest voices on campus. But when you look at these demonstrations, the number of participants grows as the draft becomes more of an issue, right? So the students who are protesting because they themselves do not want to go to Vietnam to fight. Had they not been drafted, I'm not sure that they'd be participating in any sort of anti-war protest. It was a very, very personal issue for so many of these students. And then, of course, once the draft is reformed and once we're out of Vietnam, though that does take several years, but you really see the protests just dwindle. I mean, they just, it's almost down to nothing. So I mean, that's a great point, and I'm glad that you said that. I mean, most the story that we or the mythology that we have about this period, a lot of that also comes from, you know, newspapers and sensational headlines and covering the size of the protests and the number of participants, but not saying, you know, how many of these participants were actually radical, how many of these participants were engaging in the police or with, you know, committing acts of property destruction or arson. I mean, those numbers are so small. And also, I mean, just the fact that it almost completely ends by the time the war's dwindling down is proof enough that these people are not lifelong committed radicals.
Well, that's true. I mean, because they're just people at the end of the day, you know. Who went, most of whom probably went to college to further their prospects and to move on in life, and, you know, history and circumstance radicalize them in certain ways. I guess that you took this kind of mythologization at the time through like newspapers, who, you know, are drawn to a good story. But the, you know, the real story, I suppose, is how the kind of the liberal ideas or left ideas of those campus radicals filter into the mainstream in the coming decades. But certainly attitudes towards, say, sexuality or
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Civil rights or what have you, you know, arguably were transformed because of the 1960s. But also there's been this cultural, essentially cultural civil war ever since with this very well-coordinated and well-organized and well-funded backlash. And that leads me to wonder, is it true to say that in the mid-1960s, conservatives looked at the state of the world with kind of horror? Or were they, did they feel particularly threatened by what they saw?
As college student, I mean, I'll just speak to college students. I don't think so. I think some of that horror had to be ginned up by the people who were their leaders. So the Buckleys and the other mentors. And of course, that was the whole mission of, I'll just stick to talking to Buckley for a second, but there are other magazines, there are other editors, but Buckley in particular, the mission of National Review was to provide what he would call an alternative media, right? The claim that he laid is that American media as an establishment was far too liberal. And then over time, of course, now the right uses the word liberal to mean leftist, which it's not. I firmly don't believe that we have a strong, there are leftist media publications today, but that's, you wouldn't call the New York Times a leftist magazine unless you were on the right. I think in Buckley's, trying to gin up a movement, that's, he's got to convince 17, 18, 19 year olds that yes, your way of life, as you know it, or as your parents may have experienced it, is rapidly changing because look, we're integrating the colleges, or, we're not requiring students to attend chapel service or, whatever it is. And that, if I can draw another parallel to today, the discussion we just had about, some of the hippies being overrepresented in the media and the way that we think about them, the same thing is happening now, right? If your listeners have followed the recent events at Harvard and MIT and Penn, the recent resignation of President Claudine Gay at Harvard, that is, again, not representative of American campuses. The average American college student goes to a community college or a large state public school, not Harvard, not a private elite institution with a $50 billion endowment, right? So I forget the count now, but someone did a count of how many times Claudine Gay was a headline in the New York Times, and it was probably two dozen in the matter of like 10 days or something like that. And so, again, it's part of a media story. The public understanding is shaped by, what makes the headlines. And again, it's not representative of all of American higher ed.
Yeah. And I guess that, if you look at that, that kind of misrepresentation, that's actually quite common. That's actually sort of something that happens with a degree of regularity. So coming back to something we were talking at the beginning of interview, when we talked about Karl Rove, and for individuals like Karl Rove, what was their kind of journey from those kind of campus years through to the heights of power and influence?
It's almost a straight shot. So in Karl Rove's case, he's a college student at the University of Utah. He does not complete his degree. He withdraws from the university in 1969 because he's offered a job to work in, I believe it's the National College Republicans, or it might even just be the GOP as an organ. But anyway, he leaves Utah and moves to Washington, D.C., and he works for several years as a lobbyist and a political strategist. And then, you know, by the late 80s and 90s, he's an advisor to the president of the United States.
Right. Because, yes, he was one of the old guard that was brought back in when Junior became president.
Yes.
There's another kind of sort of story which is always kind of interests me about liberals that moved to the right in the 60s. I think maybe you could have described Daniel Bell as one of those, but there were people who were broadly sympathetic towards things like the civil rights movement and believing, you know, in terms of classic liberalism, that all people should be treated fairly and have equal rights under the law. But when, say, perhaps towards the later 1960s, protest movements move more to the left, and there, you know, things like Chicago in 68, there's more kind of visible chaos. They're sort of repulsed by that and find their way. I think some of these people find their way eventually into the, like the neocon sort of movement. Was that a particular? Were those just a couple of outliers, or were there quite a few people like that?
Yeah, I think they're mostly outliers, but maybe a handful. So you mentioned Daniel Bell, David Horowitz also comes to mind, and there are others. I mean, there, even if you go back a few generations, there's even more extreme examples of like former communists like Whitaker Chambers moving to the right. So yeah, I mean, they're there and they're very, very, very fascinating to me. But I think I also have, and perhaps I'm just being, I just look at this very critically. And I think there's almost a bit of a grift that goes on from people who say, oh, I used to be, you know, the enemy, and now I have seen the light. Now, you know, now I'm on the right side of history, or, you know, the right side of politics. And I think that becomes their shtick.
Yeah.
And so the fact that they continue to stay in politics, moving, you know, from one end to the other and not saying, you know what, perhaps let me be a little introspective about this. Maybe my politics are wrong. Maybe I need to be quiet and keep thinking about this, right? The fact that they don't step away from politics, but they stay in and they, you know, sort of like do an about face and they're on the attack to their former side. I just look at that very suspiciously. I'm not sure what exactly to make of it, but it seems to be in pursuit of something.
I suppose a lot of these people, you know, to be in politics and to be anything other than a sort of the most superficial of career politicians, you have to articulate your belief, and you have to, you know, our beliefs are the most kind of the grounding bedrock of our world. You know, you either believe something or you don't. And to go, well, yes, you know, I was there, you know, marching against Vietnam in 68, but now some bombing's okay, you know, that kind of depends on who you're bombing and when. That's the thing. Right. I guess one thing that I did wonder was where, you know, you have people who have kind of honestly, shall we say, honestly held conservative views. They believe in things like the preservation of institutions. And this is sort of, if you're going to define conservatism, that's kind of what it is, really. You know, but in, I suppose, America, not exclusively, because Britain has no moral superiority on this at all, but America is also shaped by the legacy of slavery and segregation. So one of the institutions that conservatism, and this is the bit that isn't said out loud, is trying to sort of preserve, is essentially white supremacy.
Well, they do. I mean, some people say that out loud, and others say it more politely. They talk about things like law and order, or ordered liberty, and what they mean is quite literally ordered. They mean ranked. So if you can think of a hierarchy, that's what they like, and then you can imagine from there where all the pieces fall into place. Yeah. So I mean, it's not that quiet, and there are also, I think, in now that we're in the Trump years, and on the right, there are some anti-institutionalists, of kind of the burn it down variety, right? Who want to shred the Constitution, or they won't, they don't say that. They say they want to protect the Constitution, but actually they don't, if you look at what they do and the people that they put in power and what those people do. So yeah, I don't know. I think American conservatism is just in a weird moment that kind of almost escapes definition.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this is when I said, I thought I didn't know if you could call it conservatism at the moment. I mean, here in Great Britain, you have this, you know, the oldest and most successful conservative party in the world, perhaps even the most successful modern political party in the world. This has become this strange nihilistic kind of source of complete anarchy that attacks institutions, be it the police or the judiciary or the civil service or what have you, kind of week in, week out. And again, yeah, what that is, what, you know, what you call it, that's a job for political scientists in the next 20 years to figure out. But I guess,
yeah, I mean, I think it has to do, this is just my suspicion, but it has to do with where they see themselves in the institution. If they see themselves as controlling the institutions as they always have traditionally, conservatively, then they like the institution. And when they feel like they have, their power has waned or they've completely lost control, then they don't like the institution. So it's, it may not be the institution itself that's the thing, it's the power. And where is that power concentrated?
Well, that's quite the insight. That's, I'm going to, that's my takeaway from today. That's really kind of, yeah, I think you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But let's just talk about the book to give it its plug. Is this now, is Resistance from the Right currently available to in all online and offline retailers?
Yes, yes. So if readers are interested and they want immediate access to it, you can download the audiobook. It's on Audible and maybe other places. It's also digitally available on Kindle for instant access. And then I think shipping to the UK doesn't take very long. Sorry, I imagine you've got worldwide listeners. Shipping outside of the US, I don't think takes very long, just from an acquaintance of mine who ordered it and got it in about a week. So, you know, it's there, paperback, hardback, Audible, Kindle, however you like.
As we always say at the in this podcast, if you are going to buy the book, please try to support a local retailer. If you can avoid buying from a big online warehouse, of whom we won't mention for legal reasons, please try to find a local retailer to support, because once that network of that kind of ecology of small shops has gone, you probably ain't coming back. So.
Yeah, absolutely. Libraries as well.
Libraries, remember like those?
Request library access.
Yeah, there you go. Well, Lauren, it's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you today. And I'm so pleased that we, for the, to the, to the listenership, we had various, various sort of kind of scheduling misfires and things like that. So we got there in the end, and it was great to have this chat. And it would be a pleasure to talk with you about, you know, conservatism, radicalism, politics, and campuses at some point in the future, if you want in.
Sure, I'd love to.
Okay, all right. Well, thank you so much, and let's finish there, and we'll catch you again soon.
Okay.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape.
And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.